Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania's minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. It's been $7.25 since 2009. Governor Tom Wolf, other Democrats, and labor leaders say it's time to increase the minimum because it's not enough money to live on, among other reasons. Republicans and business leaders oppose a minimum wage increase, saying it will force employers to not hire as many people and maybe even cost jobs. The minimum wage on today's Smart Talk. Joining us is Dr. Mark Price. He's a labor economist with the Keystone Research Center. Dr. Price, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's always great to be here.
Also joining us is Alex Halper, Director of Government Affairs with the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Mr. Halper, welcome to the show as well.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you what you think about whether Pennsylvania should raise the minimum wage. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, normally, I would start this program by asking the broad question of why you support or why you oppose raising the minimum wage. I want to do something a little bit different to start today's program. Not that much different. But raising the minimum, it's an issue where both those for and against can make some valid arguments, I think. Mark Price, you'll point out that it hasn't been increased in Pennsylvania since 2009. $7.25 doesn't buy as much as it did then. Alex Halper, you'll cite that the Independent Fiscal Office report that says that the state would lose 33,000 jobs. So let's start there. How do you answer those statements? And Mark Price, I'll start with you. Independent Fiscal Office here in Pennsylvania. This is independent. This is not a partisan organization. They're doing research. They say Pennsylvania will lose 33,000 jobs.
Well, I think the first thing to mention is that the IFO report also finds that minimum wage increase would raise wages for about 1 million workers.
Right, that's right.
Now, their estimate of job loss is just that. It's an estimate. It's not actual observed
outcomes. But so is that million, that million people, an estimate as well.
An estimate based on actual data on where people are earning. They're assuming there would be job loss. And I think the best answer is to look at our regional neighbors. The minimum wage, at least through June of last year, so 2018, has increased in the region by about 25%. So in Ohio, in New York, in Maryland, in Delaware, in New Jersey, in West Virginia, every neighboring state, minimum wage has increased. And when you look at job growth overall in those states, you don't see actually job loss. What you see actually is job growth has been faster in those states than it has been in Pennsylvania. And when you look at food services, a sector that employs a lot of low-wage workers, job growth has grown faster in those states, despite the fact that the minimum wage has gone up by 25% across the region. So I think, you know, the IFO's estimates, it's their best guess as to what the employment impact would be, and it's based on their reading of a narrow list of the literature. My own reading of that literature is that there is no job loss observed in other states that have tried this experiment in the past.
Mm-hmm. Alex Halper, I'm going to ask the other part of that question. 725... 10 years ago, things have changed a lot in 10 years. Prices have gone up, rents have gone up, mortgages have gone up, medical, we know healthcare prices have gone up. $7.25 an hour, 10 years seems like a long time. I mean, how much further do you go with staying at that minimum wage?
You know, I think, Scott, the important thing to consider is what the purpose of this public policy is and where the various sides can find agreement. This turns into just a perennial debate about what number should it be and whether it should be phased in. And I think we lose sight that the purpose of these policies is to support individuals, workers, raising families who might need assistance. And what we've seen over the years is that increases to the minimum wage are simply not the most effective, thoughtful public policy to achieve these goals. You know, for a long time, there was the other side would just dispute that there was any negative employment impacts when you mandate increases to what are usually entry-level wages.
Do you disagree with what Mark said then about the states that have increased that?
Absolutely. I do think it's tough to look at overall job growth, which of course is based on so many different factors, and try to make a correlation with the minimum wage. We have seen, and again, these are not right-wing think tanks or business groups talking about job loss. This is the state's independent fiscal office. This is the Congressional Budget Office at the federal level, which estimated a few years ago up to 1 million jobs nationwide would be lost if the minimum wage were increased to around $10 an hour. And that's just jobs lost. That doesn't consider the number of employers that would have to reduce hours, reduce other benefits, businesses that might be planning to expand, or a small business that wants to open a new location, labor costs skyrocket sort of out of nowhere, okay. And all of a sudden that doesn't work.
Well, let me get back to my original question, yes. Though. 725, it's been 10 years, and the states around us, and I'm going to get to the point, though, about what other states have experienced, but 10 years is a long time considering what's transpired and what 725 bought in 2009 compared to what it buys today. I mean, is there a point where you would say, the chamber would say, you know what, 725, we've been stuck on this minimum wage for 10 years. What point does it come where you say, well, okay, maybe it's time to increase that?
I think asking about numbers and minimum wages is asking the wrong question.
It's an ideological thing with you.
Well, it's really a practical thing. What is going to get the most support to those individuals, families, individuals, low-income individuals raising families? What is the most effective way to actually help those people without risking their jobs or risking their hours being reduced? Minimum wage is unfortunately a policy that does trigger these unintended consequences. There are other states and other ways to direct support to low-income families that do not trigger these unintended consequences, and that, we believe, is what policymakers should be focusing
like
on.
Well, like what?
Well, for example, there's the federal Earned Income Tax Credit program, which is a refundable tax credit. It usually results in a check in the mail for a low-income family who's working and below a certain wage rate or income rate. It allows to consider whether they are the primary breadwinner, whether they have families. You have a lot of states that are looking at or have implemented a state-level earned income tax credit program to supplement the federal program rather than just increasing the minimum wage and kind of hoping for the best. This is actual targeted support for those families.
Now, what you just described, though, getting a check, a lot of people would say that sounds like welfare.
Well, it encourages work, and if we can all agree, look, I think we can all agree that a single parent raising a child cannot exist on $7.25 an hour. No, absolutely
way
not.
Below the poverty level.
Exactly. So do we raise the minimum wage and then kind of hope that this individual is one that benefits and not one of the individuals who's going to see their job eliminated? Or do we consider policies that direct support to those families? It's interesting. In Philadelphia, I talk about the federal Earned Income Tax Credit program. Philadelphia City Council has had to launch a campaign to bring awareness to Philadelphians that the federal Earned Income Tax Credit program exists. They estimate that there's 50,000 Philadelphia residents who aren't applying for this tax credit and leaving, I think the estimate was like $130 million on the table that they could qualify for tax credits up to $6,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I wish as much energy was put into bringing awareness to these policies that help as it is to this kind of annual debate we have over minimum wage.
And you see, that's Mark, I'm going to bring you in this obviously, but that's one of the points that we have been debating this issue. It started under FDR, and I think it started from even before it was implemented of what kind of impact it would have. But Mark Price, let's talk specifically about what Alex brought up, and that is tax credits. Is that a good way to go? What do you think about that?
Absolutely. we often hear a lot from the chamber that their preferred way of helping workers who are struggling to get by is to support the earned income tax credit. And what we rarely hear from the chamber is an actual proposal to actually raise more revenue. So perhaps we could have a capital stock and franchise tax to raise some revenue to actually have an expanded earned income tax.
Well, just so people know, that was one of the most unpopular taxes in Pennsylvania business, and it has gone away under like four governors.
And earned income tax credits cost money. And in order to have money to boost welfare for people who are struggling to get by, you need to actually put some actual gust behind doing that. And they don't do that. They prefer to talk about the earned income tax credit as sort of a better way to help workers. The reality is it's one way. And actually, if you raise the EITC as well as raise the minimum wage, that actually is the best way, because you both reward work, but you're also helping out in particular families with kids, because that's really the real thrust behind an EITC, is that you're giving extra benefits to families that have children. And that's a good policy and a good way to go. But I think it's a joint policy, not one where you have an EITC and no minimum wage increase.
Something I want to bring up that the chamber does tout, and it's in fact it's right there on your website. You say that really what needs to be addressed is the income and skills gaps that are causing the real problem. What does that mean, Alex Hopper?
Well, we hear from employers all over the state, and I'm sure it's a challenge nationally, where they simply can't find the qualified workers to fill positions that they have open right now. For I think the first time ever, there are more job openings than there are people looking for a job. And that is a pretty daunting position to be in. And it crosses all industry sectors, it seems like, and regions throughout Pennsylvania. So this is certainly should be part of this overall conversation, is creating an education system and a workforce development system that provides individuals opportunities to get the skills, to get the training and the credentials to be eligible for these open positions.
You're saying that if they had the training, they'd be making more than minimum wage.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. These are good career-oriented
type
jobs.
How do they pay for that training?
There are workforce development programs at both a federal and state level. I think we need a much more coordinated, focused effort to provide those services. That's also an awareness piece as well. We've been working at the PA Chamber to provide resources for parents and students at the high school level so they know what industries are hiring, who's planning to hire, and what sort of training you need to be eligible for these programs. But that's, you know, that may be a couple or a few years down the line. This is a crisis, really, that Pennsylvania employers are dealing with now.
I hear it all the time, Mark. And what about it? Is it an answer? Is it a partial answer?
Workforce development, and I think when most of your listeners hear this, right, when they hear, oh, employers are facing a skill gap, they think in their heads about an engineer on a shale site, right, a fracking, or they think about people with advanced levels of education. We're talking about the minimum wage, and we're talking about raising it, our hope is, to 15. That doesn't impact shale drilling. It doesn't really impact manufacturing. We're talking about low-wage service jobs. So people in fast food restaurants, retail establishments, you know, the Walmarts, the Costcos, the Targets. That's the industry we're talking about. And the idea that there's some sort of amazing, you know, need for advanced training in those sectors, I think, is a bit of an exaggeration. The reality is we really need to raise wages in those sectors.
But I want to point out that all the employers that you just named are all paying above minimum wage. Okay, now maybe not much above minimum wage, but they are paying above minimum wage. And that comes down to, in fact, we have an email here from Thomas, and I'd like you to address this. He says, my comment is, minimum wage is not meant to be a living wage. It's an entry-level payment for non-skilled workers. In my view, the only groups that work for this wage are teenagers looking for extra coin, moms that just want to do something while kids are in school, who might want the money for a little extras, older workers who want something to do. What needs to be done is to increase the middle income worker wages in medium and high skilled blue collar jobs. All I see is the good paying skilled jobs are being replaced by low skill service jobs. Now, he addresses several things there, but let's start with who is actually being paid minimum wage.
Now, I think really the more important question is who would benefit from an increase in the minimum wage? That's really what we're talking about. And an increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour 40% of the workers that would be impacted by that are 40 years and older. The average worker who would be affected by a minimum wage increase to 15 earns half of their family's income. So we're not talking about teenagers. We're not talking about moms working second jobs, although mix. But these are the people. They're people making less than 15. They're your typical Pennsylvania citizen. They're
now,
not
Mark,
teenagers.
You're talking about, we are talking about two different questions, because when you talk about who would benefit, when you're talking about going from 725 to 15, by the way, Governor Wolf is not proposing that, he's proposing 12. Yep. But when you're talking about doubling, more than doubling the minimum wage, well, then yes, you can. There's a lot of people over the age of 40. My question is, right now, who is making minimum wage?
Well, Alex wants to jump in. He can at 725.
The State Department of Labor and Industry every year produces a report that outlines who is earning the minimum wage. And what you see is generally they are younger. I think over half are under 24. You talk about individuals who are low income and raising families. Usually between 85 and 90% of minimum wage earners don't even have children. 7%, I think, in the last report were single parents. These are the individuals that we really ought to be focusing on. And the question becomes, is raising the minimum wage a good way to help, 7%? We're talking a fraction of a percent of Pennsylvania workers are sort of dictating a policy that has these very broad, sometimes very negative impacts on employers.
This is a really important point, Scott.
Okay.
This is not a debate about who's at 725. The minimum wage in 1968 was $1.60 an hour. The median wage for full-time, full-year workers was $3.15 an hour. So back in 1968, the typical low-wage worker earned at least half of what basically a middle-class worker did. Today, at 725, a minimum wage worker earns 30% of what the typical worker earns at the median. So this is the essential problem that, and this brings us back to Thomas, right? He's saying, well, this is an entry-level wage. Absolutely, it is an entry-level wage. And when we allow it to lose its purchasing power, when we push people into poverty, they have trouble paying their rent, they have trouble buying food, because we've allowed the minimum wage to fall. It hasn't increased as wages have grown in the broader economy. And that is why this debate is not about people at 725. It's about people all the way up to 15, or in the case of the governor's preference, up to 12.
And Alex, and I got to take a break here, but one final thing before I do. The point, and let me just go one step further with what Mark is saying, that, you know, now I ask him who's making 725, the two of you answered, but as the Independent Fiscal Office points out, 1 million people would see, and the governor estimates 1.2 million people would see an increase in their wages. That's not just people making minimum wage. That means you're making $9 an hour, $10 an hour, that your wages would go up. So it's not, at that point, it's not just teenage kids. It's not just single mothers. We're talking about other low-wage workers. Isn't that the case?
Look, I think if there's a way to achieve the policy goals you're interested in without risking jobs, that should be the focus. And as much as I understand why it's kind of attractive to ignore the negative impacts, and I there's this kind of mentality of, well, if you want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. That sounds good and all, unless you're one of those eggs. And if you're someone working at a business and the wage goes up and all of a sudden your hours get reduced, we've seen it all over the country. We've seen that occur. There have been reports produced that have shown that. If that's what happens to you, higher minimum wage doesn't really help you out very much.
We'll be back with a whole lot more coming up, and your phone calls, too. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I was listening to you guys talk and not what was going on in the air here. I got to pay more attention. Our guest today, Alex Halper, Director of Government Affairs with the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry, Dr. Mark Price, who was a labor economist with Keystone Research Center. We're talking about raising the minimum wage in Pennsylvania, something that Governor Wolf says is a priority for him this year. A lot of Democrats in the legislature have talked about that. Republicans saying we're going to lose jobs if we do this. So I want to take some phone calls here. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from David in Lancaster. David, you're on the air. Whoop, David's no longer there. All right, let's go to John in Philadelphia. John, you're on the air. John, are you there? Okay, I guess we have some people who don't want to wait on the line, or maybe you've answered their questions. Sally in York says they've added up 725 times 40. It adds up to $290 a week. That is not enough to live on. I think you both agree with that point. I said very early on that there are some levels of agreement here, and I think both of you agree that that is not enough to live on, considering what's happened over the past 10 years. It's just different ways of approaching how to do that. All right, so before we take more phone calls, let's go to the emails here and see what we have. Alex asks, please ask your guest to address the difference between jobs lost and unemployment. This is a good question. When wages rise, some jobs are lost, but a lot of that can be accounted for by people quitting second jobs because they can survive on one minimum wage job. What about that? And the reason I say this is a good question, between when the IFO is talking about jobs lost, that there would be 33,000 jobs lost. Does that mean that 33,000 people would lose their jobs? That mean 33,000 people would not get jobs? A combination of the two?
It means essentially that their projection is that 33,000 people would lose their jobs in the broader economy as a result of the increase. So, and again, it's an estimate based on a very narrow reading of the economic literature. And when you hear, for instance, Alex talk about the impacts of this, I think he used the phrase, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. You often hear sort of a very escalating rhetoric that, it's going to cause a lot of havoc. It's going to create a lot of trouble in the broader economy. And again, there are 20 states in the United States that have already raised the minimum wage as of this January. And there are going to be further increases among our neighboring states. Jersey's probably going to go up fairly soon. Yes.
Can I interrupt that? Because I do want to point out, and I want to ask Alex about this. The states surrounding Pennsylvania, all of them, have raised their minimum wage. It goes from $8.75 in West Virginia and Delaware to $11.10 in New York. So what's different in those states than in Pennsylvania? I mean, how can states like West Virginia, which has, if you look at median income, I'm sure a lot less than what it is here in Pennsylvania, how can states do it there, but we can't do it here?
I think if you look at all of those surrounding states, as well as states across the country, and you actually went there and talked to some of the employers, and not the Walmarts and other places that have already increased their entry-level wages, but smaller employers, restaurants, you're going to find out a much different story. And in that case, you are seeing some of those negative impacts. It was interesting. A representative, a new congresswoman out of New York, Ocasio-Cortez, tweeted a couple months ago that she was going to visit a coffee shop where she used to work. She found out they were closing down, so she wanted to go and say farewell, and she was kind of lamenting, it's a shame they have to close. What she didn't mention in her tweet, when the owner was asked why he was closing, he mentioned two things. He said his rent went up, and he said that the minimum wage is making it impossible to keep all of his employees. She supports increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and here the business that she loves and she talks about her experience there, they can't handle it. So the facts on the ground just don't match the what we hear from policymakers and folks talking about it at a theoretical level.
Where are the restaurant workers making minimum wage? I mean, because the servers, for the most part, are they're paid below minimum wage because they get tips.
That's right. The tip, and I think it's a critical point, because in Pennsylvania, more than half of minimum wage earners work in food and drink establishments. So they are typically covered under the tipped wage, which is lower than the minimum wage, and then employers are required to make up the difference if the tipped wage combined combined with the tips don't equal the federal minimum wage. Oftentimes, you know, and I'm sure it varies, and I'm sure maybe it is at the baseline, but you see wages that are well above the minimum wage being being earned by individuals within those industries. Correct.
Yeah. Mark, go ahead.
I have so many points to make.
I know. I can tell you're like chopping at the bit there.
I think coming back to Alex's key question, we actually learned something. He was mentioning New York City, where the minimum wage will be $15 an hour now, and the sudden loss of a coffee shop. And if you were to listen to Alex, you might assume naturally that, my God, they don't serve coffee anymore in the city of New York City. It's, you know, you can't go anywhere. There's no Starbucks nearby. There's nothing. It just, you know, people go without. Maybe they're drinking tea or something.
Not soda.
Not soda. The reality is that coffee is still served in New York City. You can still go on any corner and pick up a cup of coffee, and there are still workers serving that coffee. And I think this gets back to the job loss question, that when folks worry about the possible loss of jobs, there is certainly the case that there's going to be a local entrepreneur who, you know, decided one day to found a coffee shop, and it just didn't work. They don't have enough customers. Minimum wage goes up. Maybe they shut their doors. But that doesn't mean the demand for coffee disappears.
Let me ask you this, and we have a question about, you know, along those lines. Mark sends this question in. You know, I think it's ironic that the last emailer was Alex, and this one's Mark. You guys are channeling emails here. Anyway, Mark says, my question for the panelists is, where does the money to pay for this raised minimum wage come from? Everyone wants to skirt that issue. It needs to come from somewhere. Mark, I will give this question to you because when you're talking, we use the coffee shop example. Yeah, people are still drinking coffee, but there are probably businesses that are selling their coffee say, I raise my prices because I'm having to pay higher wages. So the question that Mark has, where do these higher wages come from?
Absolutely. You do not, you know, suspend the laws of economics in these debates. And the reality is that there are channels for how an employer is going to adjust to a wage increase. And this is true for minimum wage workers. It's true for all of us, including you, Scott, that as wages rise, it's going to be a question of, you know, how important are those wages in your total cost of doing business? So if it's a place like WITF, where you probably don't have very many workers who earn the minimum wage, if you do have one or two, it's a tiny impact, and so really it just gets absorbed in the overall budget. But of course, for other businesses, in particular for fast food restaurants, you're going to see an increase in the price of a bag of French fries by a few cents. You're not talking about, you know, $15 for a bag of fries. You're talking about an extra 30, 50 cents for the product. So the channels are, you could have slightly higher prices, and that's probably true in a sector like fast food. Some of the other channels are, we've seen experience from research in the South, when federal minimum wage increases occur, employers get more aggressive about training their workers. They get, therefore, more productivity. So they absorb the increase because they're getting more per hour from their existing workers. You may even have a channel where a business, as I discussed, you know, in the case of the New York City case, that business, which was a poor business model in the first place, went away and it got replaced. So there are channels. Some of them are employment. Some of them are wages. Some of them are prices. Some of them are profits. And the reality is that when you look across the states, California, New York City, all of our neighboring states, you don't actually see broad reductions in employment, even in sectors that are have a lot of low-wage workers like fast food.
I just have to say, you know, we hear from a lot of employers and mostly small businesses, you know, on this issue, and they sometimes cannot believe what they hear when this issue is debated by policymakers and advocates at sort of the state or federal level. So you're going to go to a business and say, hey, we want you to double your entry-level wage. And a small business owner, a restaurant owner whose profit margins are maybe 2 or 3% looks at you and says, impossible. And you say, oh, come on, just raise your prices. these things are not easy to achieve. You can't tell a business owner, just raise your prices, it'll be fine. Or
again, Alex, are there restaurants in the state of California? Are there restaurants in New York City? There are, absolutely. So this story that somehow employers can't adjust,
there is a Starbucks at every corner, and you know, from their from their pristine headquarters in Seattle, I'm sure when they're crunching their numbers at an international level, increasing the minimum wage in Pennsylvania is probably a rounding error. You go to a small business, a corner shop or a small independent restaurant in Pennsylvania, and you go to them and say, we need you to double. You know, there are proposals to take the tipped wage, to do away with the tipped wage and increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That is an over 500% increase to entry-level wage, to wages.
Well, in Pennsylvania,
It's impossible.
Now, what Mark is proposing is $15 an hour. The governor is proposing $12. Actually, the last Republican candidate for governor proposed increasing, Scott Wagner proposed increasing in increments. So just for some background purposes, let's take some phone calls here. Mitchell is in Carlisle. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for letting me speak. I was used to, can you hear me okay?
Sure. Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay. I was used to belonging to unions 40 years ago, and I saw they were crushed with this clever right-to-work law by Republicans. And since that time, wages have been pretty stagnant, even in the the high blue collar jobs. And then everything was outsourced. All of the factories went overseas, and to bring the products in much cheaper, anything from iPhones to steel, any appliances. A lot of good jobs were lost. Also, that I saw that the workers coming that weren't citizens, the employers are not fined like they are in Europe, where if you hire somebody black and you don't hire somebody from the United States, from Germany or whatever, you
Mitchell,
get charged
$100,000. What that has to do with the minimum wage?
Well, what they need to do is, first of all, look at corporate profits. Don't worry so much about the small businesses that can't afford. Make that the issue. Make the issue more that unions need to get started. They need to bring the factories back. They need to look at the profits to justify, well, we can't pay $15 an hour. That's probably true for the small businesses. But where does the profit ever get looked at? And cutting the benefits back for health care, for the families and all these people working, at some point or another, they have to start looking at the profits and start to make some decent laws that will protect the workers in this country.
Thank you very much for your call. And Alex, let's talk about this. Now, he makes some exception there for small businesses. But the fact is that there are a lot of large corporations in this country that are making record profits, making a lot of money. Everyone points to the salaries that CEOs are making. We know that we have an income gap in this country. Everybody talks about the 1% versus the 99%. So I know that one of the things that Mark, and I'm not going to make Mark an argument for him, but one of the things that he will say, I anticipate this, is that increasing the minimum wage, even if it's slight, that it helps to reduce that income gap.
Well, I don't think that should be the sort of the lead policy to address an income gap issue. In addition to examples from smaller businesses we've seen of positions being reduced, we've also seen larger corporations, fast food restaurants, for example. A lot of fast food restaurants are converting to sort of the sheets style for ordering of a tablet and trying to reduce their workforce. That's kind of happening already.
But isn't that technology? I mean, we are going to lose jobs due to technology.
Well, and I think it gets to Mitchell's point about automation talking about reducing some of those positions. When you kind of arbitrarily make a decision to increase that entry-level wage, you change the dynamic for a company that might be considering a reducing their workforce and incorporating more technology that eliminates human positions. That's also not something we want to, I think, a road that we want to encourage because, and this point was made earlier, for so many from a workforce perspective, you know, it's not just training and credentials, but it's also learning how to work, soft skills, learning how to operate in a work environment. A lot of people got that first job at a restaurant, at a fast food restaurant. If you're making it easier to eliminate those jobs, we are creating an even more daunting workforce challenge of people entering the workforce, maybe never even having that part-time job as a student or, you know, summertime job.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and we're running short on time. I know there's a lot to talk about. We have a lot of phone calls. We're going to get to them all as much as we can here in just a moment. Our guest today, as we're talking about the minimum wage and raising the minimum wage here in Pennsylvania, is Dr. Mark Price, a labor economist with the Keystone Research Center, Alex Halper, Director of Government Affairs with the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. 1-800-729-7532 is the phone number. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. I mentioned very early on that Governor Wolf has made this a priority this year in his second term, raising the minimum wage. The governor is proposing raising the minimum wage to $12 an hour. Here's something that he said, and remember, the governor was a business owner too. Something he said, and I want to get both our panelists to address this.
My company, back when I employed people, I had no one making even close to the minimum wage, and it made a big difference. It boosts morale when you pay a fair wage. It also improves productivity. It reduces turnover. And when you have a reduction in turnover, you also have a reduction in the costs associated with high turnover, of training, of getting people acclimated to your business. So it's a smart move for businesses.
So, Alex Hopper, I'm going to start with you, and I don't want you to be debating the governor of the state, but it is his proposal. It is his proposal. The governor addresses several things there. As a business owner, not a small business owner, but as a business owner that boosts morale, don't have as high a turnover. How do you address those things?
Well, I think the governor is correct that paying higher wages and improving benefit packages and any number of ways to improve employee morale should absolutely be encouraged. And that's why we see that a relative few number of Pennsylvania workers actually are at that minimum wage level. And lots of workers are earning raises without the government having to take action. You know, I do think it's a little bit tough. You know, I'm imagining a small business owner who might pay around or near the minimum wage hearing from, you know, the former CEO of a national, multi-million dollar, kitchen cabinet manufacturer, and thinking, that sounds great. I'll just close down this, my small coffee shop and open a national multi-million dollar manufacturing plant. It's a little bit of a different dynamic, similar to the governor signed an executive order raising the minimum wage for state employees. Again, I had businesses calling us saying, yeah, you know how nice it would be if I could wake up one morning, sign a piece of paper, and all of a sudden all of my workers get a raise? I'd love to do that, Alex. That's not the way it works.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you say after hearing the governor?
With respect to the governor, I think absolutely he makes very good points. And when you're a listener, you're out and about and you go to a business, and more often than not, if you see the worker, the same worker, when you go back several times, maybe over the course of a year, that's usually a good sign that the employer is actually paying them pretty good wages, right? That a lot of the turnover that employers see is a result of the fact their wages are very low. People can't make ends meet. They take jobs as soon as they can find a better one quickly. So certainly, you know, I think, thinking back to Alex, I am sitting to his right today, and he just put me sort of in the position of defending capitalism, which is sort of an awkward position for me to be, but I'll take a shot at it.
Feels good, doesn't it?
It feels great. I wish I had a better suit. The important thing to remember is that we do live in a dynamic market economy, and businesses rise and businesses fall based on their ability to meet customer needs and demands. And sort of when you listen to Alex talking, sort of you get this sort of statist vision of small businesses. You know, this little guy who's running this little shop, paying people poverty level wages, he deserves to exist in time. And I think the reality is that if you can't pay a livable wage, right, if you can't pay enough for people to afford rent, if they have to, you know, couch surf with friends and family, they can't afford food, they have to rely on the local food bank, you probably shouldn't be in business, right? The reality is that businesses, when wages go up, if a business can't handle it, it will go away and it will get replaced by another business. And some of those businesses will be small and some will be large. I want to sort of, this discussion has assumed that all of the employers that are paying very low wages are small businesses. And the reality is that's not the case. A significant number are
very large.
Along
the same lines, we have a caller talking about the same thing. John is in Philadelphia. John, you're on the air.
Thank you, Scott. Can you hear me this time?
We can hear you, yes.
Oh, great. Because I'm the same John who you couldn't hear last time.
I figured that, yeah.
Good morning, Alex. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, John.
Yeah. My point is, and getting into the economics of it and along the lines of what Dr. Price was just saying, a caller earlier said, you know, where does this money come from? Well, in fact, a lot of it comes from increased spending. When wages go up, people have more money in their pockets, more money to spend at the coffee shop, more money to spend at the dry cleaner at the hardware store. When somebody gets a raise from $7.25 to $10, $12 an hour, that money is not going into a Swiss bank account or the Cayman Islands. It's being spent locally, and it's being spent immediately. It's an economic stimulus, which is why I think that when they say, you know, if you raise the minimum wage, other people's wages go up, not just the minimum wage worker, that's because there's more money in the economy.
Hey, John, let me...
stimulates growth, and that's a good thing.
We'll address that. Thank you very much for your call. Mark, by the way, that's how capitalism works. I joke with Mark, because he has a good sense of humor. But, Alex, the point that he makes is that we are in an economy based on consumer spending. And if... And the research has shown that when minimum wage for low wage earners, when they make more money, they spend that money. It puts more money into the economy. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, first, I think we're going to fire Mark as capitalism's spokesperson. it was a good run.
But look, it's sad.
You know, I think John raises a point that is no doubt a factor, and a reality in many cases. But again, I think it's very easy to support this policy if you are willing, if you are embracing all of the potential positives and very conveniently ignoring all of the negatives that we also see from experience is going to happen. I don't necessarily think it's part of capitalism to have a government entity come in and say, by the way, your labor costs just got increased by 400-500%. Deal with it. Figure out a way to raise prices. You know, I know that makes it more difficult to compete with some of the national companies, but sort of deal with it. So these are all things to consider. And again, I think it comes down to what is the goal of this policy, and what is a way to achieve those goals that don't have the negative consequences we always hear about.
Here's Ellen has a very good question, an email question. As a small ice cream stand, I hire a number of 15 to 17 year old kids for their first job. They need a tremendous amount of training and babysitting. They learn a lot, but they really are in a learning position, not a job that is paying the rent or that they are trying to live on. If we're considering raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, there needs to be an exception for those teenage jobs. Mark, what she's talking about, exemptions. Some of those states that have raised the minimum wage have exemptions for certain jobs, certain ages of their employers. Would you support exemptions to raising the minimum wage?
I wouldn't. And the simple answer as to why is that when you look across Pennsylvania, workers under the age of 20 they earn up to an average of 30% of their family's income, right? So these stories about, you know, a small ice cream shop, you know, struggling to get by, on the other side of that story is a kid who is looking at a cost of attending college and get those skills that Alex thinks is so important that has skyrocketed over time, in part because we've cut taxes for businesses, and so we don't have money to pay for to reduce tuition at our colleges. And those kids earn important money not only for themselves, but their family. And that, to treat them differently, as though they're not a worker, as though they're not doing valuable work, is a bad idea. And it also doesn't make a lot of sense, because I don't want an employer to build a business model that basically runs on, I'm only going to employ people less than 19 years of age.
But wouldn't that answer the, you know, the argument that there would be fewer jobs out there, that the small businesses would, you know, have to cut jobs or maybe not hire as many people if they have entry workers, maybe under the age of 18, that are paying a minimum wage of, say, less than $12.
Again, I think it's a, you know, to borrow one of Alex's phrases, it's a, the unintended consequences are what I would worry a lot about.
I wouldn't want
a bunch of employers to suddenly decide that their business model is going to be profitable by only employing people under the age of 19, right? That there are unintended consequences. So you want one basic minimum wage that prevents employers from engaging in wage theft. That's one of the reasons why we oppose eliminating, why we propose eliminating the tip minimum wage, because workers unaware of how that policy works often find themselves victims of wage theft by their employers.
But going back to the ice cream stand, she probably is going to hire less people.
Think about it. What happens at the ice cream stand if she hires fewer people, Scott? The line gets longer, and where are all those people? They're not going to stand in line for more ice cream. So she's in a spot, absolutely. If the wage goes up, her labor costs are going to be higher. Her labor costs are going to be higher. She's going to have to raise the prices.
Go ahead.
Dr. Price is a brilliant economist. No one would dispute that. Ellen is hearing Mark talk about, you know, a story about a small ice cream shop. This is not a story. This is Ellen's life. And she is providing to young people, yes, people need training and credentials in college. I also can't overstate the importance of these jobs for high school kids, summertime jobs, providing those soft skills, interacting with a manager, showing up on time. For all the employers that talk about we don't have applicants with the right skills, even more are saying we don't have applicants who have the very fundamental employability skills of showing up on time and interacting with other workers. Ellen is providing those skills to Pennsylvania's future workers. We should be applauding it and pursuing a policy agenda that encourages it, not telling Ellen your story is nice and all, but whether you close or not, that's just kind of the laws of the economy when the government decides what your entry-level wages for high school students is going to be.
It's called capitalism.
We have about 2 minutes left, and this is not enough time, obviously. I mean, this is, as I said, an issue that has been debated since Franklin Roosevelt, during the Roosevelt administration, implemented it back in the 1930s. You know, we're not going to solve the issue. But looking here at Pennsylvania, what is going to happen? The legislature, Republican-controlled legislature, Mark Price, has already said this does not look like it looks like a non-starter at this point.
I think the reality is, when you look back to 2006, we had a minimum wage increase, and the leader of the Senate, Joe Scarnati, and the majority leader, Jake Corman, both voted for a 38% increase in minimum wage. They actually negotiated it. So I think I'm a little bit more optimistic that there's possibility that we may see some movement. I think the real question is what the leadership in the House, where they land. I think the Senate probably could be persuaded to go for some kind of minimum wage increase. I think the real sort of unknown, the wild card, is how the House is going to shape up. Because in the most recent elections, we got more supporters of a higher minimum wage. But I think the reality is, among the Republican caucus, that meant they lost a few moderate members from the Southeast.
Alex, a minute left. I know it's difficult to predict what the legislature is going to do, but I mean, if I can gauge just by my callers, most support increasing the minimum wage. I don't know what polls show. Polls, I think, are over 50% in support. What about it?
Look, I think it is always going to be a political rally cry. The posters are already printed up. They have been since the 60s, and it's a very effective. It's a policy that the public generally knows and understands, and that's why it's pushed every year. And what I hope, I think what the business community hopes and advocates for low-income families hopes is that whether it happens or not, that it isn't viewed as the final policy, that there's actually a thoughtful discussion about how do we help low-income families without risking their jobs.
Mark Price is with the Keystone Research Center. Alex Hopper with the Pennsylvania Business Chamber of Business and Industry. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about the prices of health care. As of the first of the year, hospitals must list their prices and fees. And that would seem to be a good thing. But as you'll hear tomorrow, it's not exactly the easiest thing to figure out. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. Also, look at legislative priorities for 2019.